Welcome to Conversations with Lulu. My name is Lulu Khazan. I am an entrepreneur living in Dubai, an investor, a mother, and your host. So this is episode 21, and my guest is Ramesh Hadi. Ramesh is the current managing director at Facebook for the Middle East and North Africa region. And by Facebook, I mean the Facebook group of apps that include WhatsApp, Instagram, Workplace, Messenger, and Oculus. So what I wanted to do is to get a small peek into Ramesh's career and learn from him as he's made some pretty big moves. A quick note, as I was preparing for this interview, I asked some of my friends who are also Ramesh's ex-colleagues to tell me a little bit about him. And I thought it would be interesting to share it with you just to know what kind of person Ramesh is. So here's what I was told. So, very well cultivated guy. He's a lot into philanthropy and angel investing. Extremely charismatic, extremely nice and smart, super lovely with clients and very respectful of others. A true testament to Ramesh's leadership. And he definitely earned the respect of his ex-colleagues. And we'll hear more about leadership from Ramesh in this episode. We talk about Ramesh's Lebanese origins, how he grew up in Saudi Arabia, and his subsequent move to the United States, where he finished his studies and then launched his career into consulting. He then jumped on an opportunity to co-found a startup in San Francisco. We will learn more about that. And then he eventually went back into consulting and back into the region. And the last role he had in consulting before joining Facebook was a senior partner at Booz Allen Hamilton. You'll find this episode enlightening if you are looking to enter the workforce or if you aspire to work for these big companies, big multinationals like Facebook. You will learn more about the culture in this company and what do leaders like Ramesh look for when they're looking to hire people. If you are an entrepreneur and looking to raise some funds from angels, you will also hear from Ramesh about what he looks for when he is assessing a potential startup and what's important to him. If you are in government, in policy, or if you are an ecosystem enabler, whether it's SMEs or startups, I'm sure you're going to appreciate Ramesh's tips on empowering and enabling SMEs, and also how do we create funds that have a specific strategy to drive growth in a specific sector of our economy. So this conversation is extremely rich in content and in advice, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it as well. So for now, let's hear from Ramesh. What's really exciting going on in Facebook land at the moment, in the context maybe of the MENA region?
Well, actually, maybe the inverse of that question is an interesting way to think about it. Like, what's not exciting at Facebook? I mean, every day there is something new, whether it's a new platform or a new feature or a new capability or a new issue or a new problem or a new challenge. There is no dull moment at Facebook. Mm-hmm. And that absence of dullness, I suppose, is best summarized as the cost of relevance. Facebook is among the most recognized and most engaged businesses, platforms, experiences on the planet. You know, we've not had really anything like this in history, right? Over 3 billion people connected, active, engaging, expressing, living, fighting, arguing, complaining, everything happens on this platform. Yeah. And it's very much in line with the spirit and the mission of connecting people and giving opportunity for communities to thrive in its beauty and sometimes in its ugliness. So never a dull moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to go back to your question around what's particularly exciting right now in MENA, Middle East and North Africa, there are a couple of really exciting things that come in response to challenge and dilemma in some case, and come in response to characteristics of the region.
Okay.
So one is Facebook Shops. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I saw that that WhatsApp has announced like a kind of a payment system within WhatsApp. So
payments is one dimension.
Facebook Shop, I know that there is a marketplace on Facebook.
Yes. So Facebook Shops came in response to the reality of COVID, that businesses, for the most part, are already engaging digitally. While it's evolving and becoming more seamless, and the notion of engagement goes from people discovering products to now products discovering people, large businesses for the most part are engaged digitally and in the digital mm-hmm. economy. But the micro, small, and medium enterprises who historically have relied on physical engagement, mm-hmm. I need you to come to my counter, I need yes. you to come to my shop, I will sell you something, and we have a physical exchange of good or service. In COVID, this was blocked, right? Mm-hmm. Physical mobility went away for the most part. And so we came up in a very short amount of time with the ability to introduce a virtual experience to any brick and mortar of any size in a very small amount of time. And Facebook Shops gives you, the entrepreneur, the ability to have a storefront,
okay.
to have a menu, to ultimately get a payment gateway, maybe even a logistics solution.
Is this live now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This was,
there is payments and...
So payments, depending on geography, there's all kinds of regulatory conditions that have to kind of be met and assured. But it is moving forward with dramatic impact and dramatic uptake. And it's been a lifeline.
And is it language specific? So yeah. Can you get like Arabic? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So it's incredibly exciting because it's a lifeline for so many businesses, right? Remember, small, medium businesses, mm-hmm. They're the backbone of any economy.
And they're already on Facebook on a personal level. They're familiar with the platform.
They may or may not
be. As individuals.
Yes,
they probably
so
are.
People
so
are
familiar.
Online. It's actually a very good point, yeah. Lulu. No, people are in this part of the world connected. Okay, they have access to data. Yeah. Some more expensively than others. They have a mobile device or a smart device for the most part, and individually they're there. But as a business, they're not. In fact, when you look at the number of businesses, over 40 million businesses across North Africa, the Levant, and the GCC, the percentage of businesses that are actually engaged in any commercial online transaction is abysmally small. The other one, so this is in response to a dilemma, a challenge. One that is in response to a characteristic, and it's not unique to MENA, but it is heightened in MENA, is the video narrative, right? In this part of the world, we consume 2 to 3 times the global average of video content. Okay, people enjoy, value that kind of visual experience and that kind of engagement mm-hmm. experience. And so our ability to reach consumers and our ability to have advertisers engage with consumers through a video medium is an incredibly powerful and an incredibly useful tool to maximize relevance of supply and demand, of content and consumption, right?
Okay.
So video as an advertising medium in stream is something that we're absolutely leaning into.
Right? Okay.
So this is a...
As in like native videos recorded on
advertising
Facebook?
Videos.
Okay.
Yeah. So the introduction of video content to engage consumers.
Okay.
Then you can, you can expand on that. You can start to say, well, hey, wait a minute. What if I added in, the ability to kind of click and buy off of this, or I click to a platform and I'm able to purchase and I'm able to obtain a product in short time, in close proximity. It opens up a whole new world of secondary and tertiary businesses that can be around these platforms, in orbit around these platforms, which creates ultimately wellness. Yeah, it gives people new opportunities that didn't exist before. Yeah. And ultimately, the region starts to evolve from being highly dependent on public sector employment to more private sector employment. And the micropreneur or solopreneur who required this physical engagement and who's now living and thriving digitally can not only preserve their job, but they can create a job and then create multiple jobs and then use these new mediums for engaging people in different ways. It's an explosion of opportunity.
You speak passionately about getting businesses into the digital economy. You talk about this quite a lot. And as an entrepreneur that ran a B2B to C marketplace, it was always very challenging to reach businesses because it's, you know, maybe your customer is the business, but how do you find that individual, for example, that is making the hiring decisions in my case? And I think most of them were not online, and we always kind of struggled, like, how do you connect, how do you reach to these businesses? So I guess part of your mission is to get everyone online as well. So that, and that, in your point, unleashes like economic opportunities for them, for the, you know, for the customers.
100%. You nailed it. That's exactly right.
What's been prohibiting businesses in your view in our part of the world? I mean, you see in Europe and the US, everybody's kind of digitally connected somehow. You have digital payments, you have some kind of social media presence, but here you don't have that.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think governments all across the region are asking themselves a very similar question.
Is it like a user experience issue?
A number of things. I think there's awareness and education. I think historically there may have been an access bias. So, you know, the ability to have a coverage and connectivity was limited. Particularly true in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, which is why Facebook has invested so heavily in the Simba, the two Africa subsea cable all around the African continent.
What is Simba?
It's the subsea cable that goes around the African continent to bring connectivity.
For data. Okay.
Yeah. And then we have a group within Facebook called Mobile Partnerships, which actually goes out. Facebook builds networks.
So you're
investing. We lay fiber. I mean, it's amazing.
Okay.
It's amazing.
To enable more people.
To get more people connected. And, you know, at one point there was a mission around connecting the unconnected. And while it might have a different label now, we fundamentally see wellness and prosperity correlating very strongly to, you know, the ability to kind of connect and have internet access and ultimately to do business online. And so while people individually have been connected, you know, they have a mobile device and they have, an internet connection, the leap to then saying, hey, I want to move my business online and I want to engage with people outside of my physical radius hasn't fully happened. And why we're investing in making this a prime objective for at least Facebook's impact in this part of the world.
So how is being the top person in Facebook? I mean, for all of us outside, this is a fantastic position and role for someone to have. It's a great company. It's a leading company globally. And, you know, how does it feel like for you to be leading this organization?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I'm honored to have this responsibility in this part of the world. And I think, you know, like in all things, there's a perception of something and then the reality of something. and, you know...
Do you wake up every morning like the rest of us and, you know, you have your coffee and you go to the office? Or no?
I wake up and I think, what's going to happen today? But
do you check your phone?
I check my phone. I check my phone.
Oh, that's
but that's a habit from the past. It's okay. Not a...
That's a consulting habit.
It is maybe. A consulting habit. It's a bad habit. You know, I think having learned from friends who have, evolved their sense of wellness in life, yeah. Many of them say that they keep the phones outside of the bedroom
yes.
and don't check it till yes. they've woken up properly. So
I'm
not there yet.
Elevated.
I'm not
yet.
There yet.
Okay.
I'm not there yet. But, you know, I think Facebook as an organization is an extremely interesting, organic, organic experience. I think many of the rules that I have learned in my consulting career mm-hmm. around organizational behavior and organizational design and reporting lines and efficiency and the like, for corporations is very different in Facebook. Facebook operates in a much more of a startup kind of way.
Still. We have thousands of people.
Tens of thousands of people.
Okay.
And somehow that character, that ethos, that pathos is dominant. And it works. So this notion that, impossible for work. Well, evidence demands the verdict, right? Facebook is a living, breathing, thriving example of this. It gave the world social media, and it operates as a social network,
mm.
right? So relationships and bonding and getting along and collaborating works across mediums, across geographies, across functions. And you realize that as much as you are empowered to do whatever it takes to succeed, your ability to do it on your own is minimal. You have to work with others in order to make impactful, sustainable outcomes.
Is that the difference between, in terms of culture, between consulting and Facebook? I mean,
for the most part, I would say. I mean, consulting is, maybe put it slightly differently. Mm-hmm. In consulting, you have to derive an outcome in a very specified, constrained amount of time with finite resources.
Okay.
That's the objective, that's the outcome, that's the output, this is the input, clock is ticking, go.
Mm-hmm.
So your ability to do things by consensus is reduced because time is not on your side. Right? So in many ways, it's a much more directive environment.
Okay.
Do this, do this, do this. Show me, show me, show me. Check, check, check. Redo, redo, redo.
Okay.
Done. Yeah. In Facebook, it's not like that at all. There's the philosophy of leading by influence. So getting people to do things, not because you told them to mm-hmm. do it, but because they come to believe that it is the right thing to do. So people, action is compelled by belief.
Yeah.
And it's been an incredible experience for me in evolving my own leadership style. It's been brilliant, actually.
It's different. Yeah.
And it works.
Mm. But you were an entrepreneur in your previous life, so you know that
yes,
to a certain extent.
To a certain extent.
Yeah. And what do you for people listening to this who are maybe young, going into the job market? They look at companies like Facebook in awe, and what do you look for in people within Facebook? Like,
actually, a great question, Lulu. I think what I look for in people hasn't necessarily evolved, hasn't necessarily changed. I think the characteristics of success perhaps are universal. I don't know, hypothesis.
Tell me.
I think there are essential ingredients. Okay, obviously there are exceptions. It's not like if you don't do this, you don't succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty of examples and outliers of massive success that don't maybe fit these criteria. But I think being team-oriented is essential, right? This goes back to the point that no one person, is an island mm-hmm. that can self-sustain. Clearly, there are examples, there are exceptions to this, but for the most part, being team-oriented will serve you well. Being intellectually curious will serve you well. Finding innovation and inspiration in even the most mundane of things on the surface gives you energy and motivation. I think people who are investing in creating as many facets to themselves will invariably find facets of resonance with others. So maybe fueling team orientation is the ability to kind of connect with others because you have created diversity in your own life. Mm-hmm. Be well-read, listen to music, try different foods, learn about new culture, expand your mind, mm-hmm. right? And obviously there are great exceptions to this who are absolutely singular in nature and, you know, find massive success. So yeah. This is not a hard and fast rule, but these are things that I think are ultimately can be very useful. And the traditional one, another traditional one is don't be afraid of hard work. Mm. Roll up the sleeves. I think there are very few truly brilliant people in this world. Everybody else just has to work hard.
Yeah.
We have to work hard.
True.
Right? Roll up the sleeves, take it on. You're not alone. Give it your all. Extract energy from others. Give energy back to others.
That's important.
It's super
Nobody
important.
Talks about energy. I think that's very important yeah. in a company. You can see it, you can feel it when you walk into a company and the energy is not right.
Exactly.
I think it's important. Okay.
So, you know, these are things that we look for.
Good. I wanted to give a shout out to my friend Ray Darham, who is the founder of Step. Ray is also the host of a new podcast called The Mette Conversations, where he hosts successful entrepreneurs from the region and does deep dives on product growth and operations. You can find the podcast The Mette Conversations on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, and on Anrami, so make sure to check it out. So you've been an entrepreneur before, which I didn't know, and I was surprised to know. And not only an
Why
entrepreneur.
Surprised to know?
Because I thought, first of all, like...
Corporate,
and then you've achieved so much in your life. I didn't know when you had the time to squeeze in a startup.
It's all blended together.
So, and when you told me, I was shocked. And it's not only a small company, it's, you know, you co-founded a company in San Francisco, and you grew it into a big business that got acquired. I'm sure you can tell us more. But like... Quickly, like what prompted you to kind of move? Because you were in consulting before that. So what prompted you to move to there and maybe share some of your experiences?
Sure. I mean, one kind of gave birth to the other, for the lack of a better description. I think, the late 90s was an interesting time for consulting. It's an industry that has been around for maybe 120 years at this stage. It was first started by a company that is still thriving today called Arthur D. Little. They sort of invented this domain. And it's sort of come in and out of it, I suppose, at different points in its story, but I think the history and the legacy of consulting is attributed to them. And then one of the other very early starters was Booz Allen Hamilton. And so it's an industry that over time has become extremely relevant and a vital asset in the evolution of business. It has equipped institutions, whether public or private, with access to insights, access to capability, to problem solve, to opportunity acquire, in ways that institutions in and of themselves, in-house, for a long time, were never really able to do. You could go hire great talent that was dedicated to a question or questions at hand, that gave you an unbiased, arm's-length answer to something.
Okay.
Yeah? And it drove a premium value. It was expensive.
Still is.
And still is. Yeah. Still is for the most part.
So just to clarify, you were in the U.S. at the time, right? Because you grew up there. You didn't grow up. You grew up in Saudi.
I grew up in Saudi.
And you went...
I was born in Lebanon.
Born in Lebanon.
My father was working for Aramco.
Okay.
So a couple of months old, my mom, comes over to Saudi to be with my father. And I grew up in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
On the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, a place called Ras Tanura.
Interesting name.
Okay. Ras Tanura. In Ras Al Khaimi, we have Ras Tanura.
Okay.
Which I suppose means it's a similarly shaped geography.
Yeah. You reminded me of the Lebanese song Hala for some reason.
And I grew up there, and then at age, and I went to the Aramco schools, and then at age 14, I got shipped off to boarding school, because school in Aramco only went up to the 9th grade.
Okay.
So boarding school, university, so on and so forth.
But in the U.S., in New York?
In the U.S., New York, then New Jersey, then I worked out of Boston as an engineer, went back to Canada. But
for grad school.
Yeah, so you were asking me about consulting how did I transition into the startup world? And so here was this industry that was dedicated to kind of helping businesses move to whatever next level, either solving a problem or acquiring an opportunity. But over time, people leave the industry, and pretty soon there were more ex-consultants than active consultants, and the know-how that made it captive, that made it unique, became much more available. And so you started to find more commoditization of consulting, right? You couldn't compete on a process, you had to compete on an answer. Okay. And so it was facing its own sort of challenges as an industry, and at the same time, the first dot-com bubble came about, right? And this whole organic activity of technological innovation that was happening in the US was starting to come more and more clustered, money started to flow towards it, and this first bubble came about. And as Alan Greenspan, the head of the Treasury, used to call it at the time, the days of irrational exuberance were afoot, right? Money was coming in, big ideas, things were investing, and so the talent that you found in consulting firms, these type A, hyper-intelligent people were thinking, well, where's the next big thing? This thing is kind of maybe plateauing a little bit. And so there was a lot of exodus from consulting into the startup world because it required strategic thinking, hard work. Many of the characteristics that you found in consulting were needed in the startup world, but with a hockey stick in terms of upside. That was kind of my transition. It went from being a consulting project to, hey, let's go out and actually make this happen. And it took on a life of its own.
Did you do it with other people as co-founders?
Yes. I mean, it was a consulting engagement, which then in fact became a whole business value proposition, to which then there was a capital raise against the idea.
Were you able to raise capital easily back in the day?
Extremely. But that was the whole point of irrational exuberance. People were investing things that probably were investing in things that they probably should never have invested in.
But you raised before or after the bubble, the dot-com?
In the middle of it. So we were, money was flowing for every idea under the sun. And this project became an opportunity to kind of say, hey, let's put a price tag on this and get someone to invest in it. And that's essentially what had happened. And a big check was given, and that big check turned into a very large valuation.
Big check.
30 million, 20 million, some big number.
Wow, okay. And the company is called?
At the time, it went through many different names, but the name that we landed on, the name that became public, the name that drove its value, was Abbreviate.
Abbreviate. Yeah. And it's a sourcing, right?
A B2B sourcing company.
Okay. And it was sold?
It wasn't sold. We tried to sell it.
Okay.
That didn't work.
Okay.
So we tried to take the company public. The initial valuation was extremely attractive. And for being a shareholder in that business, it was the kind of valuation that would make you think, I don't need to work anymore, mm-hmm. and maybe my kids don't need to work anymore. So it was extremely exciting at the time. But the bubble burst, and the underwriter basically came back and said, hey, we don't think it's the right time to take it public. Let's wait a little bit longer. And wait a little bit longer became, you know what, let's not do it altogether. And then that became, well, why don't you think about selling the company? And then trying to sell the company didn't yield the kind of offers that that made sense. And so we kept it running. And the key investor at the time eventually absorbed it into other assets that they had at the time.
Okay.
So in a way, the function still exists.
Some stressful days.
Oh, man. Yeah. Very stressful, but also very exciting. I mean, I learned a ton.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of a startup. I mean, you know as well
that
you wear many hats. There is no job that that you'd say is beneath me or above me. Mm. Everything has to be done.
Was there a bit of a slightly personal question, because you've done so many things on your career. Was there a proud moment, or let's say one of the sort of best moves you've done? Is there something like that, or a pivotal moment perhaps, or you see your career being, I can't say linear because it's not really linear.
And I don't think of it as a career per se, that it's sort of some kind of track with a beginning and an end necessarily. It's like I'm on a journey, okay? I'm on a journey and I am learning a lot about myself along the way. I'm trying to do good along the way. I make mistakes. Mm. I have successes. I try to learn from them positively and negatively. I try, some of the hardest lessons I've had in life have been how not to take things personally.
Oh, wow. That's a tough one.
It's really tough,
especially
when you're invested in something. You feel that a judgment of that thing is also a judgment of you. And that's...
You're talking in general, not entrepreneurship now, right?
No, in general. Well, it applies in entrepreneurship and it applies in the corporate world.
Yes.
And the other one is how to accept things as the right answer if you wouldn't have done it that way yourself. So accepting that other people's work under your leadership can produce the right outcomes even if you wouldn't have done it that way. So it's this innate need to kind of say, this is how you should do it, right? It goes back to that other philosophy of more directive. Do this, do that, do this, do that,
mm-hmm.
right? Part of my own evolution has been accepting other people's way as the right way, as a better way, right? And it stems from inspiring people to do things as opposed to telling people what to do. Does that make sense?
Yes, of course it does.
Yeah.
Of course it does.
So I haven't thought about my career in a linear way. Mm. I've thought about, well, what experiences would I like to gain? Where do I have opportunity to have impact, make a difference, derive insight and learning, become better?
Mm.
Yeah. But do I have an end state in mind? My confession is I actually don't.
Mm.
Maybe I should. I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know. But I tell you what I do enjoy more and more is really making a difference for some of the smallest people and institutions out there. Yeah, I mean, it goes back to this notion that I want to make this part of the world somehow better.
Mm.
Yeah, I want to create opportunities for people.
I'm gonna get to that actually in a little bit, because I think it's something to say, but I think it's very difficult to do
it really is.
Here. But going back to entrepreneurship a little bit, are there any lessons basically for entrepreneurs or now, you know, because you invest in companies now as an angel or as a VC? You have a fund?
We don't have a fund.
Okay, no. So what do you, you know, what do you look at when you talk to entrepreneurs? Are there some telltale signs?
Yeah. It's evolved. Like, I think a lot of people put extreme emphasis on, you know, the entrepreneur.
Yes.
It's all about the entrepreneurs. It is in large part about the entrepreneur.
I do that.
Yeah, but you also have to look at what are they creating? You know, is the business logic there? Is there a value proposition?
At what point do you invest? Early stage or?
I used to do very early stage.
Okay.
I think that's still very, very important.
Okay.
But I want to invest in things that have a fighting chance. And I don't know, you know, you don't always get it right. And it's not only about my investing. It's also about, my investing cash. It can also be about investing time.
Do you do that?
And investing mental capacity. I try to, absolutely.
Yeah, you have bandwidth?
I don't have much.
That's
so,
why you want
so
that.
I have to be very selective. Time is is a currency. It's a resource. And so I look for viability. I like business logic. I like things that have a fighting chance. I'm an activist by nature, right? Like, if I believe in you, it doesn't mean that I'm never going to tell you what to do or suggest ideas for you to consider or debate with you or argue with you. You know, there are many people that spray and pray, as the saying goes. Oh, here's my money, and I believe in you. You're the entrepreneur. You'll figure it out. Okay, go to those types of people. Mm. Don't come to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you want to figure it out, let's figure it out. Let's roll up our sleeves and get into it. But I've got to believe in it, and not just believe in the person. I've got to believe in the person. I've got to believe in the value proposition.
So you spend time on your due diligence?
When I can, yes.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of time.
Okay.
I wish I had more. Which is, I'm telling you that my earlier comment, that one of the things that I have learned about myself is that I enjoy this. I would like to do this more. Investing time, helping small things get bigger, building things, evolving things, connecting the dots on things, which again is also part of my role at Facebook.
I think you would be a great beyond mentor. I mean, if you look at the accelerators that are in the region today, one of the biggest critique is that, you know, not many people are actual operators, and a lot of them haven't built a startup in their lives.
That's right.
Goes to the investment community as well. And you hear that, you know, all the time. It's not, you know, my personal opinion. And I think to elevate where we are to the next level in terms of the quality of the startups, the quality of entrepreneurs, you need this kind of caliber coming in and supporting and spending more time beyond money. Because I think, you hear a lot about, we're here to add value. Every VC in the region is here to add value, but I don't know
The VC space in general is a challenge, is a bit of a conundrum to me.
Okay,
here, okay. Because first off, there's a lot of money. And so,
well, there is
a lot of money that is available. You know, whether it sits in the coffers of the VC or is accessible to the network of the VC, there is money to be deployed. Yeah, and so these startups, in many ways, if they're onto something, will have access to a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think the VCs in general perhaps try to take on too great a percentage of the business for the value that they bring into the equation. And I think in many cases, not all, but in a number of cases, the expertise that the business deserves isn't fully there. You know, I think VCs should be connecting the ecosystems around the startups even better. They should be thinking around a bigger radius of relevance than just serving a region. I love some of these VCs that are much more globally oriented, mm-hmm. and there are a few of them based out of out of this neck of the woods that
anyway,
are
you need that
particularly
because
good. Yeah.
Beyond a certain funding point, you need access to global capital.
You need access
to global. Cannot be done here.
Absolutely.
And it hasn't been.
Exactly right. And so, I think there's an opportunity for the VCs to change their game. And when you think about, or to evolve their game, and some are clearly ahead of the pack, and there are a few that are really stand out. But as as an entrepreneur, there are essentially three categories of playing, right? You can either be trying to originate something, the first of a kind. You can be trying to propagate something. It exists somewhere else. Let me team up with them and help that business expand within the region. Or let me replicate and localize, mm-hmm. right? I'll copycat it and make it a bit of our own. Mm-hmm. And I think there tends to be a lot of overemphasis on origination.
As in new ideas?
As in brand new ideas.
Do you think here?
I think historically there has been, yes.
I think it's like tremendously discouraged. So as an entrepreneur, I tell you, like, my experience is that when you typically go and talk to VCs here, it's usually... Okay.
Where has it happened before?
Yes.
Who's done it?
Yes. And it's usually okay. Like a dipstick test or whatever of where this business can go.
It could be. I mean, I'm obviously not at the table of all of these VCs.
Actually, one of the biggest complaints that I hear from the entrepreneurial community here is that there isn't money for like innovation, and there is money for e-commerce. There is money for, you know, things that, yes, we're done outside, are successful, the localization part of it. Mm. That's my sense. I think...
Then it must be just the nature of people coming across my desk or coming to me.
Maybe.
That they always are coming with, it's never been done before. What do you think?
Yeah. Send them to me. interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you attract these people? That's interesting.
I don't know.
Okay.
But, you know, clearly there are many ways to play, and I think, the prize is big. There's plenty of opportunity, plenty of need, and then plenty of
funding.
I think
we need to see more, though.
Funding.
We've had a few big exits, and I think we talk about them all the time, but I think we need to see more happening.
I can't disagree with that.
Yeah. In this book, Ecosystem Arabia, that you were featured in, there's a lot of great points that you made, one of which was about the countries, because you talked about being optimistic about the region. So let's wrap up with this, actually. It's very difficult, I mean, to be optimistic, I think, for me, about the region.
Why?
No, you're going to slap me.
No, not at all. Tell me why.
Look, I grew up in Lebanon, okay? And in Lebanon, if you're not connected or you have wasta or you come from wealth, my opinion is that your chances are, you know, quite limited. The Gulf is a haven, as you said. It's a great place to be. And I've been here 20 years, so I think I'm staying. But it's like when I look at Lebanon, for example, and the region, excluding the Gulf, you know, it's quite challenging. Having built a business here and tried to scale it and hit a lot of obstacles, it's just difficult. And everywhere you kind of look, you see bad things happening in a way. So you said in the book that you are an optimist by choice because it's easy to think like me. So tell me about it.
It does take a lot of energy to remind oneself of the longer game. Because you're right, every day there is another tear in the social fabric. And every day there is a thread that is being pulled. And every day the lace and interlace that has held us together gets unraveled in some way, shape, or form. So I agree that, you know, it is natural to feel down about certain things, about a lot of things.
Maybe as a Lebanese more so, actually.
Maybe if a Lebanese.
Especially now.
Or a Palestinian, or Algerian,
yes. Yes.
Or Libyan, or Iraqi, or and Syrian. I mean, there are a lot of people who feel perhaps disenfranchised or lost. And I by no means want to diminish the reality that they have. It's painful. It's difficult. But I take a step back and I look beyond the immediacy of that situation. And while I do what I can to help in the immediacy of those different circumstances, either on a personal basis or through on a corporate basis, and you know what we've been able to do in Facebook to help on the back of the Beirut explosion and in a number of other areas is an indication of what other corporations can also do. Similarly, in the acuteness of people's circumstances. But looking out and beyond, I'm reminded of some particularly compelling things. One is that that if the demand for small and medium business loans across the region were funded, it would be probably a fraction of the total spend on armament, and it probably would generate millions of jobs, tens of millions of jobs. So there is a way to create jobs.
Is it 4%? Was it the
I don't know.
I think it's a very small number.
I mean, whether somebody said 4% or 10%,
yeah.
We will never know because it's
you can't even
it's
open
opaque.
A bank account, by the way.
It's opaque.
Let alone get a loan.
It's opaque. It's opaque. So I think, you know, there is a mechanism to get funding to those that need it. I think what the digital disruptions that are happening are showing us that people can connect and they can thrive and they can reach audiences and they're not bound by a physical geography in the way that they have been before. There's access to learning, and it's not about what you just get in the classroom. The classroom is being reinvented. Mm-hmm. I think healthcare and general health of society, you know, pandemic aside, even though we're facing it with a counterforce, that is Newtonian, right? and it's inspiring because we're doing it in time frames and in a pace that we've never seen before. And granted, there are some that are faster than others.
Yeah.
We have a generally educated and literate society, obviously with variances, but overall, people are able to consume and process information. There's a connectivity in MENA that is higher than the global average. There's smart devices in the hands of a higher percentage of society than many other parts of the world. We have a collective GDP bigger than that of India. We have a younger population than I think India as well. So we've got assets. We've got educated, connected people.
Mm-hmm.
Our laws are evolving, right? We're rethinking bankruptcy law. We're rethinking cross-border trade. We're rethinking payments. I mean, these are all assets that equip us to play a very different game in the future. I'm supremely hopeful about this. We have a young, talented, hungry, frustrated society that usually can come together in a very positive way. It needs nurturing. It needs, you know, prodding, and it needs some direction, but it's better than the absence of these things.
Mm.
Yeah, so this is what makes me hopeful.
So you feel the ingredients are
there. We
maybe
need to emphasize certain things, de-emphasize certain things, like the point that we were talking about earlier around, you know, how can government, for example, direct activities a bit more, right? Historically, we would say, oh, we create a small and medium fund to support the community. Or maybe we do like an entrepreneurship program, or we do a digital program. I think it needs to evolve. It needs to become more focused around a geography's right to win. Everyone has a right to play for the most part, but where do you have a right to win? And I think the correlation between the traditional sectors of success and the spillover into the digital world makes a multiplier. If you're famous for retail, go down the retail tech path. If you're famous and successful when it comes to agri, go down the agri-tech path. Yeah. You've got access to expertise and insights and resources and materials that gives you a right to win more so than just a right to play. Mm. And so I think that extra layer of direction can go a very, very long way. Gone are the days of saying, I've dedicated 100 million or 2 billion for entrepreneurship. Yes, great. Give it some more focus. Mm-hmm. Show people where, don't stop them from doing other things, right? But encourage them to go in those areas that you have the right to win. And so these things make me optimistic. I see it, it's there, we can do this.
So what do you recommend to young people? I want this podcast to reach young people, hopefully inspire them a little bit. So you have four kids.
I do.
One of them is, you know, going into university soon. Mm.
Two of them.
So what do you tell them about the region, about like the skills of the future? I mean, do we really need to be lawyers anymore? Do we really need to be coders? You made a point about coders. Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. And I don't proclaim to know anything about anything. I mean, I have my own observations. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. I mean, what I talk about with my daughters, who are 17 and 16, is that this notion of artificial intelligence is not a new phenomenon. I mean, we've been talking about it since the 1940s, right? Isaac Asimov came out and basically warned the world around the hyper progression of artificial intelligence and the impact to humanity, some 80, 90, 80 years ago. But I think where we're taking it and the reality of the fourth industrial revolution around emulating human intelligence in a way that we've never seen before is that highly codified things are ripe for disruption. Highly codified things, because we can process data in ways that we've never been able to do before. So I think those industries that are highly codified, pick up the text, look at article 2, subparagraph, kaza, blah, 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 I think those are going to change dramatically, right? But those industries that require us to use right brain, left brain, pulling things together in ways that we haven't thought of doing before, is a place to focus. Life. And so that's my direction to my daughters. Industries that require design, understanding human behavior and combining that with tech, or economics and healthcare. It's, MIT has a fantastic kind of the mantra of the university. It's mens e manus, the mind and the hand. We were talking earlier about Steve Jobs. He said his mission in life was to marry art and science. Mm. And so polarity, for me, the convergence of poles, creates incredible opportunity, right? And so my encouragement to my daughters is, think about how you marry your passion for history with your passion for coding. How do they come together? Mm. I don't know. Or your passion for behavioral economics and your passion for biology. I don't know how they come together, right? Mm-hmm. I can't see that yet. But I think those are the things that are worthy of exploration, bringing different things together. And maybe in the end, entrepreneurship and success of an entrepreneur is not something so nebulous, so big and fluffy. In the end, it's like, hey, I just want to figure out how to Uberize a bus, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. And it becomes something much more micro. But yeah. I think that introspection probably triggers some of these epiphanies along the way. That, oh, okay, I could do this, or oh, I could do that, right? So they're young, right? And right now I'm encouraging them to think left brain, right brain, and where they converge. Mm-hmm.
We spoke briefly about success metrics, and I'm going to end with this. And you're successful by a lot of metrics. And, you know, for people that are trying to kind of, you know, there's this big question, like, what is success to you? Is it financial? Is it, like, meaning? Is it, so what, how do you define it for, again, for the people who are listening? What do you say success is?
You know, I don't tend to think about it much, really. I think
about your own success or about success in general?
About what is success and what is, and how much. I think it's almost like what is happiness, right? It varies 15 times a day.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Thank you for saying that. It's like such a difficult question.
Yeah,
what makes you happy? I don't know.
I don't know. Like.
And you feel under pressure that you have to say something.
Yeah, my son making me a cup of coffee in the morning, saying,
oh,
"Hey, good morning,
Dad." Okay, that
makes me happy. You know, but so you know, it goes up and down too much, and so I don't, you know, trying to kind of be happy all the time, I think is a challenge that's not top of mind for me. I think happiness is determined in hindsight. You look back and you say, overall, how has it been?
That was good, yeah.
And for me, I think success is the same way. You look back and say, what is it? I think the real mission is to live, I mean, it's almost Aristotelian.
Aristotelian.
In the sense that, you know, I think to live virtuously, to try to do good, to employ yourself, your mind, your hands, in doing something, building something, creating something.
And you do
something.
This, by the way. So I've read that you're into, you do a lot of philanthropy, you sit on boards.
But whether it's you do those things or you just try to kind of make the meal every morning and keep your kids in good health, and curious about learning. I mean, they are equivalent. You know, there isn't one that is better than the other. So I think employing the talents that one has in doing good and moving forward will, in the end, result in one looking back and saying, "Ah, that was successful," or "Ah, that was a good life. That was a happy life." Every day pursuing happiness, not for me. I mean, I would rather focus on doing good.
What motivates you? Something? Is there something specific that motivates you in general?
I think passionate people motivate me.
Yeah.
People who consider all the facts and choose to be dedicated and motivated, you know? People who find it in themselves to laugh. People who find a purpose in things, yeah? And that purpose can evolve and change. I think those things give me energy.
Thank you so much, Ramiz.
My pleasure.
It was really an honor having you here.
No, my honor is mine. Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. I hope you found Ramiz's insights and advice helpful. As a parent, his advice about the skills of the future and how we should marry between the right and the left brain was extremely interesting. As a parent, it's definitely a big question on our minds. How do we mentor and guide our kids to be as successful and as happy as they could be? I also love Ramiz's optimism. for the region, and I look forward to see what else he's going to be working on in the next decade or two or three. As usual, if you like the podcast, please subscribe and leave a rating or a review, especially on Apple Podcast. Also, you can subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can visit my website, conversationswithlulu.com, where you can see other episodes, read some blogs, and you can also contact me through the contact form if you have any guest recommendations, feedback, sponsorship or collaboration opportunities, and more. You can also find me on social media, as usual, on Instagram, Twitter or LinkedIn at Lulu Khazan. So I want to wish you a fantastic day, and see you in 2 weeks.